Hello. All right, we're here.
Well, thank you so much for coming to DEF CON and also for coming to our talk here on how to disclose an exploit without getting in trouble. As an initial matter, you should know that, I have to tell you, I guess, that I'm an attorney. But despite that, Well, actually, I'm an attorney. I represent hackers. And one of the things that I think you might like about this talk, I hope, is that in addition to Todd's excellent portion of it, is that this is not about the law. It's not about what the law is. It's not about what the law should be. I don't like going to those talks myself, and I imagine you probably like them even less. What this is really about is it's about trying to keep you safe, enabling you to continue to do the research that you want to do without getting in trouble. It's that simple, and there are just basically a few pointers that we're trying to get across and some techniques and some ideas about how research can be done and how disclosure can be done that will increase the safety for the research community. One of the things we're not going to be able to do is to completely eliminate risk. This is kind of a risky business in a lot of ways. And what we can do is we can manage it, and we can be aware of it, and we can reduce it and mitigate it as much as we possibly can. So with that said, I should tell you that this is part two of a talk that I gave in a 20-minute slot here last year. And it's worth giving an update on this because some things have happened since then. In particular, the United States Department of Justice and their computer crime section is now actively engaging with the research community. And they're getting together, they're having sit-downs, and they're looking for a way forward because they recognize that there is potentially a chilling effect to the way computer crime laws are being interpreted and being enforced. And they recognize that there is a public good in the research that's going on, and they want to find a way to make sure that the bad guys, or the right bad guys, however we define them, are deterred from doing the bad stuff. But the good guys are still unable to continue to do what they do. So as an initial matter, should introduce Todd.
Yep. Hello, I'm Todd. Oh, hello. I work at Rapid7. I work mostly on Metasploit, maybe you've heard of it. And I deal with a lot of disclosure issues all the time. We sometimes find our own ODAY and then go through a disclosure process that's pretty easy and straightforward. Sometimes people will come to us and say, like, hey, I have this awesome bug and I don't know what to do with it. And so we just kind of help them say what we think they should do. And sometimes people just drop ODAY on Metasploit in the form of a pull request. And so, hooray! I think that that approach is totally effective at getting some attention on it, and it's probably the highest possible risk you could take, especially if you're standing in a jurisdiction that shares jurisdiction with the vendor that you're dropping ODAY on, and that could be a problem. But anyway, I'm Todd. That's my PGP key. The first one is the one that lives on my phone, so it's okay. The second one lives on in here, actually. It's here, so good luck. And that's it. So, Jim.
All right, so my contact info is here as well. PGP, Red Phone, Tech Secure, Silent Circle, et cetera. Twitter as well. Anything works. So just again, as an overview, what we're going to cover here is the risks, two types of risk, the risk from the activity, the research activity itself, and then there's also the risk that comes on the back end when you disclose that research that maybe no one else knew about before, some risk mitigation strategies, and then some ways that you might be able to do disclosure while keeping that risk to a minimum. Overall, the point of this is to make yourself a harder target. Okay. So what are the kind of activities? It's always worth just getting this out there. What are the kinds of activities that are potentially risky? They're on a spectrum. There are no real answers. There are some things that are probably not too risky. There are some things that are really, but that are much more risky. On the sort of less risky end, one might be changing an HTTP query string and seeing someone else's utility bill. This seems like a relatively innocent thing. Technically, yes, this could be a violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. We'll get to why this is not necessarily a big risk for you if you do that. But technically, that is technically a violation of the law in almost any context. Another example would be you find out your neighbor's Wi-Fi has got the default password or no password, and you're able to access some files and see some things on that network. A little more risky, you break some DRM, or you write a better rat and start using it out there somehow. So the risks, the bad things that could happen to you, your research could get buried. You could be barred from disclosing it by a court order, usually by a vendor perhaps, or there may be some pressure from a government who also is interested in this not coming out. You might get sued, and you might accidentally disclose zero day. So all these things could happen. But I don't want to put too negative a spin on it, because there are some rewards for disclosure, as you can see. No, it's not really that bad, sure. But we'll find them. But it's really just, I think, as we'll find out, that the best reward you're likely to get is probably some recognition, hopefully. And if we do it right, that'll be it. So the main thing everyone's concerned about right now is the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, because there have been some very high-profile prosecutions of some members of the community that have a lot of sympathy. And the sort of active, without going into the details of it, because we don't really need to for the point of this presentation, is the meat of it, the ambiguity that causes so much trouble, is that what you need to do to fall within the statute is to access someone else's system without authorization or exceed the authorization that you had been granted. And it's very hard to figure out what is authorization, how is it granted, especially when you're out there on the public internet, because we're not engaging in this back and forth. Can I be here? Yes. Okay, come in. No, you just show up. So that's that makes it really hard to answer the question. But we can kind of break it down into like a simple checklist. This, if you can check all of these boxes, there's going to be some risk. Are you connected to the internet? Well, if you're just in your own box, doing your own thing, you're not really in the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. You might have you might do something else that runs into some trouble, but at least you don't have this problem. Are you accessing a remote system? It's not yours. Do you have permission to access it? We don't know, right? That's what we were just talking about. And did you obtain information? You probably did. Otherwise, what happened? It's not a whole lot of point to being there if you didn't. Here are some example cases. And this is really where people start getting concerned. Because the point of these cases is to give you some idea about what kind of activities have been charged under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. In some of these cases, the charges were ultimately dropped, or the cases were dismissed or reversed on appeal and so on. But this is not about the law. This is about, am I going to get arrested? And even if you win in the end, it's too late, right? What kind of things get you in trouble in the first place? Since we're in Vegas, a good one to mention is the case of Nestor, who exploited a bug in video poker. And what he was able to do was play one game and then switch into a bit up and then switch into another game and get out these huge payouts. He didn't actually connect anything to the video poker machine, didn't change any code, didn't hack the machine. He caused a code that was written for that machine to be executed exactly the way it was supposed to execute. It just gave out too much money. He was charged under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act under a hacking statute for that. There was another defendant who had other people use their valid employee login credentials to obtain information from the first gentleman's former employer. No one hacked anything, but access was made to that system. Of course, there's the case of Aaron Swartz, who, among other things, spoofed his MAC address. Andrew Orenheimer, who had a script to run queries on a public-facing API and get a lot of email addresses. And then Jeremy Hammond, who pulled a whole lot of emails out of Strat4. So these are the type of activities that are the subject of high-profile Computer Fraud and Abuse Act prosecution. But there's also the risk of civil prosecution. And ironically, you're far more likely to be sued on the civil side than by the criminal side. There are hundreds and hundreds of cases where employees actually get sued by their employers because the employee has been terminated or left for some other reason and decides to take some documents with him. There's other trade secret claims, other intellectual property claims that you see in those cases, but the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act gets loaded on with that too. But even though many of the activities that these researchers were engaged in seem to be just really basic things that you should be able to do, why can't I query this public-facing API? I can do this all day long. That's not unauthorized. They've made it available, right? So no passwords were required to do it. But what we find, what you'll see, is that in the cases that are actually getting prosecuted, there are these aggravating factors, these extenuating circumstances that make that prosecution feasible, make it happen. I know it doesn't give you a lot of comfort, because really what we want to get to a point where, you know, we know that if I do X, I cannot run into legal trouble. We'll again have another talk about what that law might look like, right? But that's not the law we have. But nonetheless, we can take a look at the cases that are out there and see what these people did beyond just the technical act. And this is where you can reduce your risk. Because even if you have to hit that public-facing API in order to do the research, there may be no other way to find out if this system works. So you may have a technical violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, but the question is the DOJ going to come and get you? Well, in the case of the video poker, this guy didn't just find out this bug, make $100 and say, cool, and disclose it to the vendor. He pulled out over $500,000 out of the machines doing that. Great use of the exploit, but that's going to, you know, grab, it's going to get some attention, right? In the case of Nozzle, where he had other employees of the company use their valid credentials to download highly sensitive documents that he was going to use in a competitive way against his old employer. Aaron Swartz entered the premises to connect equipment. Maybe that, they may not certainly have been a dispositive reason why that prosecution continued, but it certainly heightens the stakes when something like that happens. Of course, Andrew Orenheimer, famous as a troll, that made him less sympathetic as a defendant. And beyond that, he harvested over 100,000 email addresses. Certainly far more than was necessary to prove that, you know, to make his point that the system was insecure. And of course, in the case of Jeremy Hammond, obviously the intentional disclosure of the sensitive documents for the point of making those documents public as a statement. So there are some, in this context of this really overbroad statute that everyone recognizes sweeps in legitimate security research, and in light of these aggravating factors that seem to get the attention of the Department of Justice in bringing cases, the question is, well, what do we do? What's the takeaway? With respect to the risk of in the research itself, stick to the proof of concept. Right? Don't go beyond that and pull down 110,000 email addresses. You know, pull down 10, if that's what it is, and then you can do this responsible disclosure, as we'll get to in a little bit. That'll keep it much safer. It makes you look much more like a legitimate researcher and not somebody with an agenda or on a mission. In disclosing, be professional. You can quote Mr. Pink from Reservoir Dogs, right? We're supposed to be effing professionals, right? I keep it that way. And in that regard, one of the things you really got to be careful about, and this can't be overemphasized, when you make a disclosure, don't ask for anything at all, because then it starts to look like extortion. I know even if intentions are good, I'm sure we've all heard many cases where this has happened or been involved in them yourselves, where you approach a vendor and the vendor becomes very hostile to the disclosure right off the bat. And once you're in this adversary relationship, it could go bad quickly. And to the extent you've asked for anything, even disclosure, if you ask the vendor to disclose it, even that could be taken as a threat. So nothing. No, don't ask for money, don't ask for recognition, don't ask for disclosure, and don't ask for employment. Any of those things, you're welcome to do that, of course. But these increase, this is about we're trying to decrease the risk of getting in trouble. That will decrease the risk. You can ask for anything you want. But the risk, you get the risk that comes with that. Beyond that, when you're making a disclosure, not just to the vendor, but if you're blogging about something that you found, you want to talk about it, there's some basic things you want to do that can help keep it help keep it safe for you. Seems kind of obvious, maybe. Don't direct technique information to someone you know might use it illegally. That starts heading in the wrong direction for you. In that vein, be careful providing support. If someone has questions for you about the vulnerability and you're not sure exactly what their intentions are or who they might be, I'd be very careful about answering questions or discussing it further. A few more points. Consider not discussing it directly with individuals. Keep the public so you reduce the risk of having a conspiracy with other individuals. Don't promote it on forums that are known to support or promote illegal activity. Maybe disable comments to avoid being in a conversation about it with somebody who might be using it illegally. And then, of course, use secure communications as much as you possibly can. Oh, we have visitors.
Go on.
Oh, this is great. Do I get some too?
Oh, you think so now. Wait, raise your hand if you're a new speaker. I'm not kidding. In the last one, there was a situation like this.
Yeah,
the guy in your position got Jack Daniels spilled all over.
Ooh.
So, if you want to give that to me, I'd be happy to.
Cheers.
To our first time speaker.
Thank you.
Delicious.
It was just the moment.
All right, so going on.
Keep doing your thing.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Congratulations.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. I promise I am actually part of this talk. It might be part of a second.
All right, yeah, we're about to switch over in a second. So, some basic ideas about disclosure here. You might want to think about whether or not you've done everything right as you're making your disclosure. If you feel very confident in the fact that you haven't broken any law, no one's going to think you're breaking any laws, and your clearance is not going to be at risk, go ahead and acknowledge your identity and put it out there and have at it. Absolutely. There's some other, we'll talk about some additional ways that can happen to do that responsibly. One of the things you might want to consider, if you're a little bit concerned, but not terribly concerned, is to offer that vulnerability up with a, we'll get into this in a minute. Let me hold off on that. So as we were saying, if you aren't sure if you did everything right, you may want to stay anonymous. And Todd will have more about how to make that happen effectively. As a last note, I just want to introduce this concept to everyone and get some feedback. The goal here is to get feedback from the community. One of the things that I'm working on in connection with the good folks at Bug Crowd is an open source responsible disclosure framework. And what we're trying to do is create essentially a procedure, a process that we can all kind of agree on that will enable researchers to continue to do their work, enable companies to accept that work, and reduce the risk. It's about reducing the risk to the researchers, reducing the risk to the companies, so that everyone can be comfortable with that and thereby promote the research. So you can find this online if you Google that. But the basic concept is that the company, whoever is being pen tested essentially, publishes their scope ahead of time. What domains you can look at, what kind of tests you can run, what you can hit, what you have to stay away from. The researcher agrees to stay in scope, of course, and that includes avoiding pulling out personal identifiable information, disruption to the service, or whatever else the company wants to keep off of. And in exchange for that, the company agrees not to pursue legal claims against the security researcher. In exchange for that, the researcher will also agree to keep the bug confidential for a period of time until a patch can be put in. So anyways, we're just going down this road now, and we're kicking around these ideas, and we'd be delighted to hear any feedback that anyone might have. And with that,
hello. Yeah. Cool. So one thing that you need to do if you're going to be disclosing through an attorney, as I did actually a couple months ago, is that you have to train your lawyer. I don't have to train Jim very much at all. Jim, his name is Cypher Law on Twitter. He knows kind of what he's doing. You know, he's got the text secure. He's got the red phone. He's got the PGP. And I asked him yesterday, it's like, so when you go to your like bar association barbecue, how often do you talk about PGP and secure mail? And he tells me, it's like, it never, ever comes up. And this is a problem. So one thing I want to do is figure out, like, how do you train your lawyer? And so last year, when Jim presented, I saw his talk, and he said some things that I thought seemed a little fishy. So we worked out a procedure wherein we could pen test it. We could test drive it. How do I disclose anonymously with my attorney cutout? And the biggest thing I get out of that is this notion of attorney-client privilege. And the idea is that if I'm a vulnerability researcher, I can find my vuln, I can see that it works, I can try not to violate CFAA too hard, and then hand it over to my attorney and say, hey, here you go. I need you to talk to these people. Don't mention my name. And if they ask, you just say, no thanks. And this, we believe, is fairly effective. Unfortunately, we didn't get investigated or prosecuted by anybody, so we couldn't really get to that endpoint. So maybe next time we'll give the DOJ a heads up or something. I don't know. The biggest thing we need to do, though, is obfuscating the metadata of the material that you hand to your attorney. When I do vulnerability disclosure, I almost always am armed with a Metasploit module. If I hand over a Metasploit module to a vendor, or CertCC, or whatever coordinating body I'm handing it over, I am pretty much giving away who that author is, right? There's a really great paper that gets cited a lot. It's the Authorship Analysis and Cybercrime Investigation. It is the tiny little URL there, so just Google it, you'll find it. It's fairly seminal. It gets cited a lot. And it's all about authorship analysis, right? It's like some people just always have like a return false unless not something, right? Which is like a bizarre way to say true. I think, I don't know. It's like really hard, but it gets used. And so this is like a fingerprint, right? So you can fingerprint people off their code all the time. So first step is don't. Don't provide proof of concept code unless you secure this hold harmless clause, because otherwise, if you open with that, you've given up the game. So that's the big thing. When you go down this path, the big thing you have to know is your adversary. If you are going against if you have a disclosure that you believe would be interesting to the NSA. Don't talk on your phone, all that stuff, right? You know, you don't talk on the phone, you don't get photographed with your attorney, you don't do anything on your computer, and you just probably should just walk away, because there's very little you can do to defend against that adversary. If you're merely dealing with a litigious multinational corporation, chances are good that you can still talk about this stuff on the phone, as long as you're aware of like where you are and who you're with, and like if your boss is like one cube over, and maybe you're dropping O-Day on your own employer. Like, don't do it at work, obviously. which has happened. I haven't had anybody lately drop O-Day on their own employer, at least through Metasploit. If you're doing it on some free and open source software project, again, you can probably talk on the phone. You could probably meet up a lot. You can do a lot of clear text email. You don't have to worry about PGP, and it's a shame that PGP is so difficult. Like, How many people have ever tried to like teach a non-professional geek PGP and was successful? Hey, look at that. That's like a solid 0.5%. Yeah, congrats. Congrats. Just keep up that good fight. TechSecure and Redphone are both fairly easy to use, and but they have their own issues. By the way, if you try to TechSecure me, I can't. TechSecure believes that I am a user of TechSecure, so all I get is ciphertext. Lol. So don't use that for me. Do it for Jim all day long. If it's an important free open source software project, you might want to tread a little lightly because, again, you may be attracting the attention of things like the Department of Homeland Security or, you know, whatever your equivalent is in your home country. You want to err on the side of anonymity, at least until you get a hold of this hold harmless clause, right? But it all comes down to just like taking some kind of reasonable precautions. Like you don't have to be super cloak and dagger about this. More is better. But it turns out that like secure communications is really hard. Me and Jim are both like pretty well versed in security, and we screwed up like at least 3 times. We totally gave away the game. We were using PGP, and then at one point, one of us, I'm not naming any names, mentioned the vendor in the subject line of the email. Whoops. So like if we were actually trying to like avoid attention from the NSA, that would have been not the greatest. Oh, and the other adversary, the unspoken adversary, is like all the people who like to drop docs on hackers. If you're sitting on O'Day in your email in the clear, you may find that you get your stuff disclosed before you were planning to, right? So, moving on to our case study. So this is a vulnerability. That is present in Yokogawa's Sentium 3000 human interface system. This is a piece of software. Yokogawa makes human interface systems. It's SCADA software that runs on Windows, like you do. It controls things like really expensive turbines and factory floors and all that stuff. It's real popular in Japan, not so much here. But it's also, they have a fair number of customers in Europe, UK, I'm almost positive in Russia and probably Ukraine. So what this bug does is discovered this. And I learned about it, and I said, "Hey Jim, I totally have an O-Day for you. Let's test this process." So we did it, and so we went through what happened. Let me back up a little bit. You can see the details. I don't have to read these slides to you. I think it's published on the blog now. Yeah, if you go there, you'll see all the details on it. That's what I was doing over here. I was just like prepping it up and writing and finishing up the Metasploit module and publishing the blog. So that was fun. And then drank. So our disclosure on this was sometime after the last DEF CON, Rapid7 and Jim, we entered into an attorney-client relationship. On April 14th, I'm obviously blowing Rapid7's cover right now, but that's okay, because it's kind of important to the show that we actually tried to do this, and it was really hard. On April 14th, I disclosed all the details to my attorney, and then we had some negotiation and back and forth on how we're going to present this, and this is where we came up with the whole authorship analysis thing, and gee, we really probably shouldn't give the Metasploit modules. One of the best things we did, let me back up a little bit. On May 1st, about 2 weeks later, we offered the details. Jim actually wrote to Yokogawa, offering details of this vulnerability in exchange for some hold harmless thing. Which, by the way, I don't know about this whole in exchange for hold harmless. Isn't that not extortion too? Or is that? I don't know. Maybe it is. I'm going to promise not to, sue you, and that's an extortion. I don't know. But anyway, they didn't reply at all. They didn't get angry. They didn't, demand to know who it was. They just didn't say anything. And I'm suspecting that when people get random, unsolicited communications from attorneys, that is probably the way to go. You don't maybe we don't want to talk to them. But I mean, we are offering this vulnerability details on their software, but they were not. I don't know why they didn't respond, but they didn't respond. On June 25th, after giving them several weeks to give us some kind of guidance on what they want to do with this, we disclosed to CertCC, not to be confused with US Cert, they're totally different. We disclosed to CertCC fairly complete details, and it minus the Metasploit module, of course. But we have a nice PDF about it, and talking about all the technical details of this bug. Which, by the way, the bug is if you're on the same network as one of these things, you can use some undocumented UDP-based commands to read and write the file system. That's all. So it's pretty good. And so then today, details got published right there. I did it. And so here's some source code, because it's not a DEF CON talk without source code. I'm going to step through every line. So hang on. I'm not going to do that, but you can read about it yourself. It's up on the blog. It's up on GitHub. It's merged to master right now. If you happen to have access and authorization to own some Yokogawa gear, today's a good day for you. this is the disclosure doc that we sent to CERT. Like I said, it details out fairly completely what the vulnerability is. Like, hey, maybe you should put some authentication mechanism in front of these like store and retur commands instead of just like letting them get run. The surprising thing to me was I wasn't super surprised that Yokogawa didn't reply. I was surprised that we didn't get much of a response from CERT on this, because I deal with CERT a lot as under my own name. Jim, I guess, doesn't deal with CERT too much, and so maybe they don't know who this dude is, and maybe they think it's a scam or something like that. But we didn't get any reply from them. I'm super curious to talk to them like almost immediately after this talk, and I was hoping Art would be here, but he's not. Anybody here work at CertCC? No? Ah, guys, you should totally come. All right. Well, I'll hook up with them later. I know where they're at. And I think that's it for my part. I've already disclosed this vuln. You can see what it did. Obviously, by disclosing it, I'm blowing my cover. The point of this particular flavor of anonymity is that we wanted to keep it. We wanted to be able to give this talk, right? We wanted to be able to disclose a vulnerability, and we'll like imagine that I just did like a whole long, boring talk about Yokogawa, right? And then I want to be able to do that. So the point is, it's not anonymity forever. It's just like anonymity for 3 months or 4 months or something like that, and that's fairly useful to people in our community. So. If you have bugs to disclose, feel free to tell me. maybe retain Jim. He was super cheap. In fact, I think I make money out of this deal because I'm the co-speaker too. That's all I got. Anybody have any questions? Please go to the mic in the middle. Climb over all each other to do it and riot.
So, Jim, I mean, you know this. Hold harmless agreements don't bind criminal prosecution, and lawyers are prohibited from using privilege to protect conspiracy to do criminal activity. So doesn't this just mostly just kind of theoretically protect you against the DOJ, and then they're still going to smack you around?
Right. I mean, that's a fair point. It's not possible for anyone except the department itself to say, okay, we're not going to pursue this action. And even then, I've spoken with people in the department and said, can we create even a no action letter sort of thing where we would be able to, the department would say, we don't think, and it wouldn't be great if we actually had a letter from the Department of Justice that said, we don't think port scanning is a crime. If that's all you do is port scanning, maybe you do some other stuff, then I don't know. But this is okay. You can't even get that. So for sure, even if you have this agreement with Yokogawa or whoever it happens to be that says, okay, yeah, give us the deets on this bug and we promise that we're not going to sue you. But it can go further. It says, we won't sue you. We're not going to chase you down. you know, assuming you didn't not risk representing what you did. If you actually did something really nasty and you're not telling me about it, you're telling me you did this, but you actually did that, then of course the agreement's not going to apply. But if you're being honest with me, you're telling me you did this, you know, or you didn't do whatever the bad thing is that we think you might have done, then we're not going to come after you ourselves. And but they can go a little bit farther and say we're not going to support a prosecution by the Department of Justice, and that's the kind of, that makes a big difference because. But MIT did. So that's the difference. And when so the cases come out in a couple of different ways. CSIPs, the Computer Crimes Intellectual Property Section of the Department of Justice, can do its own investigation if it has reason to believe something's going on, or some aggrieved party comes whining to the department saying, you know, these people are hacking my system and you guys need to do something about it. And, you know, if you're AT&T and you do that, you know, well, the department's going to listen. But you know, if you don't go to them, the department is not. No one can promise. I mean, that's the thing. No one can ever promise. But you know, I've sat down with folks from DOJ, and they tell me that we're not out there hunting the internet for people who are doing slightly fishy stuff. Yeah. So it's risk, right? It's risk. Where do you draw the line? But we can. All the best we can do is to reduce the risk, so people can continue to do the research.
So if I find an exploit, I can hit you up and you're going to do it for free, because I know my local lawyer is going to be like, what are you talking about? And, you know, I have $1,000 retainer. So, I mean, how are we expected to go out and find an attorney to do this? Because I don't think that that's something reasonable for us to do in pay out of pocket.
Right. So there is a really big, interesting question out there with respect to scale. Right. So we did one bug and it cost, it's not, you know, a dollar would be too much to pay, right, for this sort of thing. But, you know, if you've got, you know, thousands and thousands of people coming through the system looking for this measure of anonymity disclosure to attorneys, it's not, there needs to be some way to make it work. It's not clear what that is yet, but that's definitely an issue.
Okay, so question is, many devices coming out from unknown Chinese vendors with vulnerabilities in them.
Oh, sorry, I can't see it.
There are devices coming out from Chinese vendors, and they're vulnerable. And these Chinese companies are many times, you don't know who they are. There's no email address or whatever. And how do you deal with those?
So with things like that, and we have run into that before with Metasploit, typically what we do is we make some kind of effort to find out who it is first. That generally doesn't go anywhere. So we get in touch. I work with CertCC a lot, and they have a nice long list of people that they can talk to. We have gone through CertCC, and then generally CertCC will get in touch with someone like JPCert or CertCR or responsible entities in China, whoever they are. But they know who it is. I mean, the main concern that we would have is not so much. You know, I'm an American, I'm standing in America, and I'm happy to help the people of China. I totally want to do that, but it gets really hard really fast because there are language barriers, there's time zone barriers. So I can usually make a play at like ICS CERT or, you know, Department of Homeland Security and say like, hey, you know, we have all these like boxes of unknown origin. You know anybody? And it's a very personal kind of process. It's a lot of people talking to a lot of other people. It doesn't scale great, but it's that's how we do it today.
So presumably a cyber lawyer would have a fairly finite list of clients, and portions of that list would be exposed during litigation. So wouldn't just communication from that particular lawyer be a risk of losing your anonymity?
But the fact of the attorney-client relationship itself is confidential. And the identities of criminal defendants in a criminal case would be. So for example, if someone came to a criminal defense attorney and said, you know, I've robbed this bank. You know, that is confidential information that only the attorney has. So it's the attorney-client relationship is probably the most secure relationship that you could build in terms of disclosure that involves potentially criminal conduct.
And I think I know what you're saying. You're asking more about traffic analysis, right?
Like, yes.
Like if I'm emailing Jim, you know, in spates, And then Jim is known to sometimes disclose bugs. Like, it gets real easy real fast to figure out who he's talking to. So, I mean, obviously you'd want to, if you're really that concerned, again, like, it's your adversary. Like, if my adversary is GE or AT&T, like, they're not, unless I'm using AT&T's network, they're not going to be really have a lot of reach into, like, getting a hold of my email. Sure, they can try to subpoena Jim all day long. I mean, good luck subpoenaing an attorney for, like, you know, all your points of contact. I don't think any judge would ever do that, ever. But, you know, they could try to subpoena me, but then they already know who I am. So I can have throwaway email addresses and use PGP because I know his key. That's how public key, you know, cryptography works. I don't have to ask him for his key first. And so I can just say, hey, Jim, this is Todd, and I know I'm on, you know, like, hotdude22 at Yahoo, but it's really me, I promise, you know, or something like that, you know? So that's how I would solve it, just throw away.
So I just had a question, like, clarification from the example that you presented. Like, there was no response from the vendor, but, like, if they had responded, like, in a really adversarial way, or, like, if you're a researcher and you get, like, an unexpectedly hostile response from the vendor, like, what should you do then, or, like, how do you approach that?
Hire Jim.
Yeah, you hire Jim. He's very reasonable. Generally, I've gotten hostile responses from vendors like that weren't this, right? Like, I've disclosed a lot, and when we do that, we generally just try to calm them down. We assure them we're not asking them for anything. We're not, like, trying to sell them pen testing, and that, like, a lot of times they'll get on the phone and say, "So what are you selling me here? Because I don't really need, like, pen testing services." I'm like, "Well, A, you do, and B, we're not selling that." Generally, it's talking. Like, sometimes you have to talk on the phone and just, like, be a person, you know. But it's very human hacking to kind of walk them off that edge.
Thank you.
If you're gonna go the lawyer disclosure route, like, where would jurisdiction fall in? I don't know if that's necessarily the right term, but, like, let's say you live in one state, you're the target, or, you know, the software, you know, group or whatever lives in another, or lives, works, whatever. Like, how would that play, and would it play in?
Yeah, well, the answer is jurisdiction is never found in New Jersey. That's for sure. Right, got it. Good. All right.
One guy did it.
Yeah. Thank you.
You've got to make a New Jersey joke.
That's actually a real issue, because in Weave's prosecution, they brought the case against him in New Jersey, and that was the basis for overturning that conviction. So it does. It's where matters.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Cool.
Assuming we can't afford a lawyer, you know, just as a random research, is it reasonable to contact the vendor, try to contact them? Usually it's just a website email. Typically you don't get a response, as we indicated, and then you disclose publicly on a contact or something like that.
Right. And yeah, exactly. So just for the record, this sort of disclosure intermediated thing is not something that I would charge money for. This is something that I just do for the community. It's a project we're working on. It's not like a service for sale, to be honest with you. Because it couldn't scale. It just wouldn't make any sense to do it. But to answer your question, that's really, I think, an opportunity where this hold harmless agreement could come in, where you know, if you're going to stay anonymous behind the attorney, the hold harmless is not as necessary, because it's really, you can't find out who to go after anyway. But if you are going to have an identity, then this two-step process does start to make sense, where you reach out to the vendor and you say, "I found something, and I can tell you about it, but I'd like you to agree not to come after me or support prosecution." And then there's going to have to be some negotiation back and forth, because if you did something really horrible, I mean, they're not going to just say, "Yeah, fine, we don't care what you did." So that can be worked out. But I think that could, if that negotiation process can complete successfully, then that would enable individual researchers to go to companies. And of course, the other option would be
some.
Use the Metasploit module. Exactly. Just do that.
Just give me one. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not an attorney. I can't offer attorney-client privilege, but I've done it before for individual people. They'll come on IRC, or they'll ask me on Twitter for some reason, or they'll email me. It's like, hey, I have this bug. I don't know what to do with it. And generally, I'll say, look, we can help you with it. We'll help you write the Metasploit module. Uh-huh. That's what I get out of it. And we generally just do, we tell the vendor, we wait 15 days, we tell cert, we wait 45 days, we publish the Metasploit module. And that's generally how we do it. And it seems to be working so far. I'm not in jail yet. And that's the door.
All right. That's it. Thank you so much for coming.